8:15 and welcome back to our arena special preview of the Cork International Festival of Literature, which starts next week. Carmen Maria Machado has already made her name as a writer of fiction. Her gothic horror-infused short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award, was the winner of the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Prize, and is now being developed into a TV series. She's also the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship Award and is writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Now she has written a haunting, timely and incredibly important work of non-fiction called In the Dream House, which is her memoir of surviving an abusive relationship. The book, which has just won the Rathbones Folio Prize, was hailed by the judging panel as a compelling memoir, a striking piece of storytelling and a work of art. The book is notable not just for its striking structure, divided into fragments, each referencing a different literary or cultural genre, but also for detailing abuse within a queer relationship, something that is rarely documented in modern society. If you need this book, she says in her dedication, then it is for you. I'm delighted to have Carmen Maria Machado join us on the programme this evening. It's, I don't know how to describe how moving the book is and how frightening the book is in places, but this starts out, Carmen Maria, as a love story, and as a love story where you think, yes, good old Carmen is in the dream house. She's going to live a dream life and be involved in a dream relationship.
Yes. Little did she know.
Tell us how you found yourself feeling that.
I mean, it was very strange. I mean, I remember the part of the, you know, writing the book was hard in a lot of ways, and obviously writing about the bad stuff was really hard, but it was actually strangely challenging to write about the good stuff too. You know, it reminded me, I had to sort of go back to this place that I was, what in what felt like a past life, you know, a past self that I hadn't accessed in so long. And it was very strange having to like remember what it felt like in the beginning, because it felt amazing. Yeah, it was very complicated.
And one of the reasons it felt so amazing back at the very start was the absolute and total acceptance of you and seeing you perhaps in a way that others hadn't seen you previous to this.
Yeah, you know, I spent a lot of my life, I mean, for a lot of reasons, I was sort of a late bloomer, and I had never really found my place, sort of, you know, I had never really sort of got a sense of myself, you know, in relationships or in a romantic way. And meeting this person, I remember thinking to myself, oh, this is what I've been waiting for this whole time. You know, this is what everyone says. It's like, you just need to wait for the right person. And it felt, yeah, it felt faded. I mean, it felt sort of, which sounds so dramatic, but like when one is in one's early 20s, everything is kind of dramatic. So,
and we may well laugh at all of that now, but how quickly did you realize that far from being in a dream house, you were in a nightmare house?
I mean, it's sort of strange because people ask me this a lot, and I feel like the answer, it sort of differs in different ways depending on what you're noticing. So like, you know, I didn't have the language for what I was experiencing until much later, you know, after the relationship was over. And I think that part of what made it so difficult to extract myself was, you know, all bad relationships with abusive dynamics, you know, they're not always like that, because if they were, no one would get into them, right? You know, they're good, and then they get bad, and then they're good again, and there's this sort of cycle. And so, you know, I there are sort of various moments in the book where I talk about like the first time that my ex-girlfriend, I say in the book, you know, she touched me without love, like she grabbed my arm and squeezed it to stop me from saying something. And, you know, that was like a very chilling moment for me. And in retrospect, I think, even though it like feels like it's weird, it feels minor sort of in the scale of things, but it was that first moment where I was like, that doesn't feel correct. And yet I still dated her for, you know, almost a year after that incident. So like, it was sort of a strange, like multi-step process that eventually took me, you know, a sort of what I thought of as like a sanctioned reason to get out of the relationship, which was, you know, infidelity, even though that was like very low on the list of terrible things that happened.
Yeah, because the type of physical and emotional abuse that you detail here is truly frightening and truly horrific. But I'm interested in quite early on, I'm not sure if it's close to the particular event you've just described there, but it was an instance of jealousy. There's a lot of jealousy and much of it unfounded type of jealousy involved. At which point, at one point, when you, I think you kind of you were comforting a stranger in a public toilet who needed some mm-hmm. help, and your ex-girlfriend turned around, she was very angry about it all, and she said, "You are not allowed to write about this. Don't you ever write about this." And then she uses a few expletives and asks you, "Do you understand what I'm saying?" That, to a writer, what was your, I mean, the shock must have been there in the moment, but as a writer, mm-hmm. when you think about what that says, how do you feel?
I mean, it's strange because now looking back on it, I mean, with the sort of the clarity of being, you know, a decade past those events, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like, you know, writing was my voice. It was my way of speaking and being in the world. And, you know, I mean, I was just in a very early stages of that when this happened. But, you know, whether instinctually or deliberately, she understood that there was something that needed to be sort of muzzled or shut down. And she found it. And she found any excuse she could to use it. So, I mean, I feel like with this book coming out, I talk a lot about how, like, we sort of romanticize things like jealousy. You know, we say, like, oh, like, if, you know, your jealousy just means someone really loves you or cares mm-hmm. for you. But of course, that's not true, right? Jealousy on that sort of extreme level, that sense of possession, is very like abnormal and not romantic at all. So I feel like it was too early on for me to recognize what it was, and I didn't really have the framework of understanding that, and also had sort of the one way in which I sort of knew how to articulate myself clearly taken away from me.
So
I had agreed.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you obey? Did you just not write about it for a long, long time? Or were you writing in secret? And given the relationship you're in, writing in secret would have been a very frightening thing to do.
So it's weird. I was not writing in a deliberate way. What's very strange is that I was writing other things that later, when I looked back on it, I was like, oh, like, I was sort of sublimating all of my feelings and it was coming out. Like, I remember I wrote a story about a couple in a relationship that had broken up, and I wrote it while I was dating my girlfriend, and then I sort of hit a halfway point and I said, I don't know how this story ends, and then I just sort of put it aside, and then like several years later I picked it up again and realized with horror as I read it that like I had written a story about an abusive relationship. Like, that's what I had written, but I had no way of articulating that at the time. So I mostly did not write, except when I was writing and sort of, you know, accidentally writing about the situation I was in. But it wasn't until much later that I actually began sort of consciously writing about what I was experiencing
and moving
what I had experienced.
Yeah, and moving towards this book that we now have, which is called In the Dream House. Many mm-hmm. people have noted on each chapter has a title, Dream House as something or other. And in fact, the one where you're talking about how suddenly you felt, yeah, all my prayers have been answered, is Dream House as Luck of the Draw. You have other ones like Dream House as Bluebeard, Dream House as Appetite. Just explain that structure and what it allowed you to do in the writing of the book.
Yeah, well, at the time when I started to try to write it in sort of a deliberate fashion, I was really struggling because everything I wrote was terrible. So I would like write some pages and I would look at them and be like, oh, this is like truly dreadful. And I was really struggling to like have the kind of distance that I needed, I think, to write the book successfully. And I had not sort of come upon the form, as it turns out, of what I actually needed. And I was teaching at this like summer camp for teenagers in the Midwest in the United States. And I was teaching at this camp and I was every day doing these lessons about genre. And I started to just, because I, you know, when I teach, I'm sort of thinking about what I'm saying. And I was suddenly like, I wonder if maybe I need to be thinking about this as like a gothic story or a science fiction story. And so I began to like imagine these genres as these lenses into the experience. And it was just the key that like unlocked the whole project for me. So I went from having like nothing usable to like immediately just writing down, you know, hundreds of ideas, you know, many of which never even got used in the final book, but it just was like this dam that burst. And I suddenly felt capable of writing the book, which before that I think I was really struggling and I wasn't sure if I was capable of doing it.
So it's almost as if you thought, right, well, I'll turn this into a story in the following form or in the following genre. I'll do something with it that'll be a story of that kind. Then you realize, uh-oh, I'm writing a non-fiction book here. I'm not writing fiction. How frightening a moment was that?
I mean, it's It's very strange because also I was so afraid of nonfiction. And my ex used to say to me that I wasn't a very good essayist, that I wasn't a very good nonfiction writer. And so I had a lot of sort of baggage and anxiety. And I had trained as a fiction writer. Like that was the education I got. That was, you know, mostly my area of expertise. So I did feel very out of my depth, you know, as if I were writing poetry or something, where I was like, I don't know how to do this. Like, am I doing this correctly? And so, you know, it was a very like laborious process, you know, and even when I write fiction, I tend to find it very freeing and very pleasurable, even when the subject is very intense. But this book was very difficult to write. I mean, it really took a lot out of me.
Yeah. I mean, at a technical level, there are differences between writing nonfiction and fiction, but in the reality level, there is, these things happened in the nonfiction book, in the fiction book, I'm making these things up. When you're writing, these things happened and they happened to me. How difficult was that?
I mean, it's very hard, you know, especially, I mean, it's funny because I've written, you know, a lot of sexually explicit fiction. Like my fiction is, that is a thing that I'm known for. But it was very strange then to like write it about myself and write it about, you know, and I remember like at some point giving a reading and I was, you know, sitting in front of this massive audience at a bookstore in the US, and I saw a bunch of my former students in the audience, and I had this sudden moment of real fear, and I was like, I'm about to talk about the worst thing that ever happened to me, and I'm about to talk about it as nonfiction, like not as fiction, not with like a novelist sort of protective sheath. Like I am about to talk about it as a thing that happened to me, and they're like people who know me in this audience, you know, and that was very, very difficult. And I mean, the way that I sort of got through it was I would just talk through my fears. So I was like, it feels weird to talk. And I see my former students and I see like classmates of mine from college and I see people in the audience that, you know, it feels a little strange to talk about it, but yeah, I just sort of had to power through that because it's so much more intimate. It's so much more revealing because with fiction, even if fiction is based on your life, you can just say it's not.
Yeah.
And like no one can tell you otherwise, you know.
Well, we all know that all fiction is autobiographical. But we can say that and that kind of gets us past actually really answering how it fits into a fictional story. When you were writing this work of nonfiction then, particularly about an abusive queer relationship, any material that you could say, oh, well, here's a bit now, here's a bit of archive, or here's a bit of a similar story that somebody else has written about in a queer relationship. Loads of that out there. Not.
Not right. Yeah, I mean, that was also sort of the big challenge was like, you know, when I started into this project, I thought, well, it'll be probably useful to find some sort of archival material to draw on, to think about. And I just was... And also, I mean, also, I had never written from research before, so I was not an academic, I'm not a historian, you know, I was going into it in this very sort of fresh way, or not fresh, that makes it sound positive. It wasn't positive, it was terrifying. So it was so odd. But yeah, and then I just was very stymied by, like, how little we had sort of recorded. And, you know, it's always very hard when you're digging through queer archives because, you know, sometimes the archives are in someone's basement because no university has not been important enough to them to archive it. So like, there's also a lot of sort of just anxiety about, wow, we don't value certain kinds of stories. You know, and it was a very, like, and the research part was very difficult, just first because I'm just like, that's not my training, but also it was deeply sad. And I was just piecing together these stories from all over.
Just wondering about the reaction you may have had to it. You're talking about burying yourself effectively in front of students, in front of family. What about the ex, who is the other part of the story here? Have you had any reaction from her to the book?
No. It's not really a part of my calculations at all. It was not really important to me.
Yeah, I wondered, do you care about her reaction?
No.
Not at all.
No.
One final thing that I would like you to do for me is tell me some of the ways that I can get pregnant. The list that you give in the book. Because I'm going straight home to eat a melon and spinach and a lemon, I think,
right,
as well. What were your favorite mystical ways of getting pregnant?
I know. I feel like I should explain to the people listening that there's a section of the book where I am sort of going through folk tales and fairy tales and figuring out different sort of mystical ways in which people have become pregnant And oh my goodness, now I'm like looking for the pages in my book. But yeah, it's like wind, thunder, lightning, yeah, eating a series of foods, like a lover looking at you. Yeah, I was really interested in folktales and fairy tales and how they could inform the book, and was thinking a lot about sort of queer pregnancy in that way, and this sort of thinking about folktales and fables and things like that. It was like a very interesting little way
and
into
it. And it is a lot of fun, that particular section, and particularly being the thought, being impregnated by a comet. I'm still trying to work that out.
Imagine.
Carmen, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Carmen Maria Machado speaking to us about her book In the Dream House. It's out now in paperback, published by Serpent's Tail. And Carmen will be in conversation with Alexander Chee, another writer known for his challenging the boundaries of genre and structure. And that talk takes place on Friday the 23rd, 8:30 p.m.